You are listening to Business Day Spotlight.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome back. This is the Business Day Spotlight weekly podcast. Today is the 24th of April, 2019. And for today, we're going to be looking at the health of the South African economy. I think last week, we looked at some of the pressures that are on consumers in terms of inflation, how much people are spending, and a lot of the things that people are expecting out of the elections. But right now, we want to talk to someone who's actually done some country risk research just around what the actual health of the country is, looking at various factors. So that's what we're going to be looking at. So my name is Mudiwa, and I will be with you as we go in for this discussion. And I'm joined in the studio by Unomic CEO Claude Basek, who is going to be just unpacking what some of the work that they're doing is. How are you, Claude?
I'm very well, and you, Mudiwa?
I'm fine, thank you. So in terms of the research that you've done, I see that you even got the attention of Bloomberg out there, and people are paying attention. What is this work, and how did it actually come about?
It's a long story, and it's a long genesis. I'm writing an article about the genesis of this thing.
Yeah.
Because it started in 2007, 2008 with one of our South African clients coming to us and asking us what had they missed in the story of South Africa in relation to the Polokwane kind of upset.
Yeah.
And the almost immediately after the first Eskom load shedding crisis. Mm. And it was an interesting question. What did they miss? So, and my sense is that they believe that South Africa was going in a certain way, a certain direction.
Yeah.
Kind of rainbow nation direction. Mm. And, progressive, growing, becoming more inclusive. And they wake up one morning in, January 2008, and it's a very different country suddenly. I think they wanted perhaps a different way of looking at the future of South Africa.
Okay.
And so we started scratching our heads around that problem.
Yeah.
And start playing with data, really. Mm. South Africa is a country where there is a tremendous amount of curiosity about the future.
Yeah.
And I think it has to do with the fact that it's a country that's permanently on tinderhooks about its own future.
Yeah.
And I think that's been going on for a very long time. And so it's unsurprisingly a country that has been pioneering in adopting the kind of scenario analysis, scenario planning, discipline methodology. Anglo-American played a big role in that in the 1970s and 80s, and you have, household names like Clem Sumter, who have, really carried this approach through the country. And I mean, recently you had the Anglo-American Indlovamity scenarios.
Yeah.
Which are based very much on that approach and that belief. These are useful instruments, but I think they suffer from one major flaw, is that they are what you would call intersubjective. So they're not based on data, they're based on opinion, they're based on impressions, they're based on consensus.
Yeah.
So you get a bunch of people around a table and you ask them a number of questions. You use a number of basic little facts, to try to create the conversation. And then you ask them, well, what do you think is the future of the countries? How do we organize these in scenarios? But you have a lot of psychological biases and sociological biases that build into that. And I didn't want to go into that direction. I think that field is pretty much occupied. And I felt then, back then, that we, and I still feel that we need a kind of theory, solid data-centric model that is based on an understanding by an expert or by a set of experts of what is a healthy society, what is a healthy economy, what are the attributes, and how do we measure that in the most objective, comparable way.
Yeah.
And so that kind of is the quest that, you know, Unomics we've been on for, 14, 15 years.
How many countries are you doing this particular type of assessment for?
All of them. You know, we have 280 countries and categories of countries. So we can analyze countries individually. We can analyze them geographically through sub-regional and regional groupings. Yeah. We can analyze them through groupings, political or economic groupings like OECD, G20, G7, G8, least advanced, most advanced. We're using the World Bank country classification category.
Yeah.
And we find the data, and we pull the data. None of the data is ours, which is important because we're just too small to create data.
Yeah.
And we feel that it's very important when you put analysis out there that are quite hard-hitting in terms of the facts, right, as the one that we kind of spoke with about with Bloomberg, you need to really make sure that you can say, well, this data is authoritative. It's from this source or that source. You know, whether it's World Bank, United Nations, World Economic Forum, OECD, African Development Bank, and the likes.
Yeah. And as Unomics, because you obviously have an office here in South Africa, do you have physical presence in any other countries? And does that have any bearing on how you then assess the data when you're conducting your research?
Yeah, so we started in Mauritius. I'm Mauritian originally.
Yeah.
I am Mauritian. French Mauritian. My dad is French. My mom is Mauritian. So I straddle that divide. We started in Mauritius. And then, you know, we opened an office in London, goodness me, about 7-8 years ago. We had an associate there. And I felt that, you know, that's an oversubscribed market. And also, I felt that if you want to be able to, do something credible about country risk, country performance, country development strategies, country risk in strategies for corporates, you have to be, where things are happening.
Yeah.
You know, and I felt that South Africa was and is a very interesting experiment in post-colonial growth in a very diverse, very multicultural, but also very challenged society. We had a lot of interest in South Africa, mainly in the mining sector. To try to help these companies understand what's happening or what was happening and where was the country going and how that interacted with market dynamics, with competitor dynamics, with their own performances. And so we created a subsidiary here, which we call Unomics Research, because we felt that here we needed to do a lot of kind of public research, public interest research. When did we do this? I think 2014.
Okay. So about 5 years or so.
5 years or so. I started to spend a lot more time here. Eventually decided to, get a work permit and kind of settle down here a bit more.
For our listeners, I think one of the things that I really perhaps want you to articulate, especially, I guess, as an outsider and an insider, is the interest that that the world, whether they're corporates or sovereigns, have in South Africa? Because I sometimes get the sense that I don't think South Africans understand the interest that the world has. Because just from some of my writing, I've had a chance to interact with country analysts from like the UK. And when they talk about Eskom, you would swear this person was sitting with you in Johannesburg. There's a lot of eyes on the country.
Yeah.
You know, so perhaps you could you just unpack what that interest is and how that actually feeds into, I guess, the investment case for the country? And also, how do you articulate some of the idiosyncrasies of South Africa to an outside audience that actually wants to put money in South Africa, but perhaps doesn't understand fully what's going on here?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting case, South Africa, because because of its unique history and because of, and I'm going to take perhaps a Western perspective now, or Western lens on, which is problematic for South Africa too, because it's the dominant eye, right? And,
yes.
And for South Africans and particularly blacks, and it's a very problematic eye,
yes.
Right? It's the eye of Sauron, maybe. So why is South Africa important? South Africa is important for the West because, to a large extent, it has a mirror effect, of this society that is trying to get away from its post, colonial and neo-colonial structures and towards a project which is sustainable. And at the same time, so that's one half of the story, right? So the whole apartheid white minority and the responsibility or the sense of responsibility that the West has had in relation to that. I mean, Western, particularly European countries, were mostly very active against the apartheid regime.
Yeah.
Because it speaks back to our own, I think, issues around white rule, white extremism, white nationalism, which is becoming again a problem, right? From Europe to the United States, and I think in the 1980s, 1990s, there was a sense of progress away from that, and a sense that we needed to impose norms of civilization and rule of law and democracy and participation in society, by all, for all, on the same basis. The other story, the other side of that is the African story.
You know,
the fact that South Africa is part of Africa and that it was, and I don't think it still is, but it was the greatest hope, right? That, an African country would be able perhaps to bypass the typical path of development that we've seen in Africa since the age of independence, since the late 50s, early 60s, that, the country would be able to incorporate the world economy, the global system, without falling prey to the most radical forms of African nationalism and African big manism, and African neo-tribalism. Which almost every country has fallen, which then leads to either economic collapse or revolution or coup d'etats, military, etc. And I think, so you have these two conflicting views on South Africa. And perhaps now a sense that, those great hopes aren't exactly manifesting the way we expected them. That the country did better than feared, but not as hoped.
So what does the data say
about
South Africa in 2019?
Oof. The data points out to...
And perhaps you can also explain what data points you're using.
Yeah, exactly. So I was going to say, let me start with the theory, perhaps, and the model, because I think that's important in what the data says. So at Unomics, www.unomics.com, at Unomics, we believe that country performance is really actually a manifestation, a reflection of state performance.
Yeah.
And state performance is really about institutions. You know, we don't buy this kind of organic neoliberal belief that, you know, countries are made of free individuals who are kind of arrived on Earth by some magic accident and kind of then interact freely into a market of ideas and goods and services, and that somehow out of that emerges a social order. No, you know, it's a fairy tale. It's a dangerous fairy tale, as we can see in the United States, where there is this continuous assault on institutions, right? So institutions of the state, and by that we mean all institutions in the country, whether it's government and the courts and the public service, to you know, individuals and associations and nonprofits and businesses and all of these are institutions. They all belong to the state. They all are part of this thing. The us, the common us, you know. And the institutions include both things like businesses and government departments to beliefs, like a constitution. A constitution doesn't exist. It's a commitment on paper to some common shared values.
Yeah.
And so without those, you can't have a functional society. And so there's a lot of work that has been done on you know, on this. There's in the 1990s and 2000s, there was what we call the return of the state. You know, I mean, the World Bank, I think 1997, which had been really archaically neoliberal, and you know, until in the 1990s and 1980s. You know, had its annual report book called The Return of the State, which led, with other things, to really a lot of scholarly focus on this. And you know, one of the factors was the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, I mean, you had that notion when the Soviet Union collapsed that it was a wonderful thing that society would reorganize itself from its, you know, individuals and...
Yeah,
and instead, what you had is you had the total collapse of a culture with the rise of organized crime, corruption. I mean, it was chaos, right? And so the guys started thinking, "Oh, okay, well, you know, clearly we need the rule of law, and you can't have the rule of law without functioning institutions. You can't have functioning institutions without, you know, capacity, fiscal capacity, technocratic capacity. You can't have that without, you know, trust and social capital." And, you know, so there's clearly a system of theory of that. So that's what we've developed. We've developed a model which is based on big data, which, you know, seeks to measure the performance of states internationally and try to understand, so, you know, what is the kind of global order of state and state performance based on a series of core indicators which more or less describe state capacity. So what are those, you know, and we're adding, you know, but the theory says that, you know, the, you know, states are functioning if they can provide four core public goods.
Yeah.
So one is effectively the securing of the national territory, right?
The good country's borders.
And inside the borders, protect citizens inside the country against crime, invasions, you know, protect foreign foreign South Africans overseas and the businesses overseas through, you know, well, defense forces, bilateral trades, investments, and, you know, agreements and all that. So the whole framework of protection of life, limbs, and property, right? The second is you have to have a system of political governance, which allows the society to make key decisions, you know, who is ruling, how those who are ruling are ruling, by whom are they appointed, under what framework are they ruling, what are the dispute resolution mechanisms, do we shoot one another or do we go to court, you know, or do we have, you know, le khotlas and do we, you know.
I think what's going to happen in a few weeks in May is going to be a good test of that system.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have this we call governance, political governance.
Yeah.
You know, and that includes the whole system of representations, governance, political, you know, the public administration. Yeah, how we all start. The third one is about really what we call prosperity. You know, what is a system of wealth creation and wealth allocation, because it's not the same thing. And the underlining, so it's economic policy, it's economic management, it's the property system. You know, are we a capitalist society? Are we a socialist capitalist society? Are we a communal society? You know, who gets what, when, and how?
Yeah.
You know, to quote the old philosopher Harold Laswell. And then the fourth one is really the system of creation of social capital and social well-being.
Yeah.
So education, healthcare, housing, access to basic goods and commodities. And all of those things. And I think we need to start including more of environmental performance, which would be, in my view, you know, a fifth kind of public good, you know.
So how are you doing on the four that are existing at the moment?
Yo. Nah, let me start. So it's interesting because we have a cluster, right? So there's a cluster phenomenon in South Africa. So the data on those four, you know, areas of performance, we only have data going back to 2006, 2007.
Okay.
That in itself is a problem. And so the story we've told, which has been publicized, you know, is based on that kind of period. But we've worked a system to go way back and look, you know, further back. So we also have data which allows us to go back to 1970, 1980. Okay. But the Bloomberg story only spoke about the first data, which we call, you know, international indices performance. So that goes back to 2006. And it's interesting because it corresponds with South Africa's peak performance in most of those indicators. So, and there is a lot of work that we've done to try to understand what that means. Okay. But the data says the following. Since 2006, 2007, South Africa has been experiencing relatively poor performance with either stagnation on some indices or decline, and in some cases pronounced decline. So let's just unpack them. South Africa was ranked really well on governance back in 2006, 2007.
Yeah.
Right? One of the... you know, we say it's in the best quadrants. We have four quadrants for the countries, you know, divide the population in four quadrants, you know, the top 25, the, you know, mid 25, 25, and the bottom 25. South Africa was in the top 25%.
Yeah.
Right? It still is in the top 25%.
Yeah.
But it was what I call in the top 25%, it was in the B club, if you want. So it was part of countries that were not the Germanys, not the Sweden, not the, you know, not the best managed, best governed countries in the world, but, you know,
they were close there.
A solid constitution,
yeah,
right, a commitment to democracy, right, a progressive political system that was seeking, you know, to get to a post-racial environment. A great Bill of Rights, you know, real freedom of speech, and a lot of that, right? And a truly independent electoral commission with truly non-violent elections, bar a couple cases in, you know, that northern KZN thing.
Yes.
But that's old. That's been going on for a while. What was called a flawed democracy, but a flawed democracy, but not a dysfunctional democracy. Yeah. It's been eroding, you know, and losing ranks progressively year after year after year. Understandably why, you know, the quality of the institutions, you know, the level of public discourse, the increase in political violence, and all these things. So the second measure on economy also doing rather well if you use the index of global economic competitiveness.
Yeah.
So also, you know, in the B club of the top quarter back then, and progressive erosion. Well, are we surprised? You know, we've had low growth, we've had low FDI, we've had poor economic policy, we've had declining macroeconomic performance, we've had increasing debt. Most of our sectors are under pressure. Right? There is no big story out there. On security performance and on social welfare, and that's interesting. It's another cluster there. South Africa was, has been, remains in the worst quadrant.
Yeah.
So, you know, on HDI, Human Development Index, we are amongst the, not the worst countries in the world, but not far.
Yeah.
You know? And we were back then, and we still are. On security and the protection of citizens against crime, quasi level of societies at war, you know. You know, 15,000 people, you know, 20,000 people killed, massive amount of rape,
yeah,
massive amount of social dislocation, etc. And so if you look at those, the location of South Africa on those four indicators back in 2006, what you saw is this: a South Africa that was well positioned on governance and economy, right, performance, like almost like a first world country,
yes,
you could say.
Yes.
And then on social performance, security, you know, that which affects everybody.
Yes.
You know, like a third world country.
Mm.
And there are very few countries in our database that actually show this kind of duality.
Mm.
We know that, right? I mean, it's a tale of the two countries. It's a tale of two economies. It's a tale of two social systems. And that's the legacy, the damning legacy of apartheid and colonialism. It didn't start under apartheid. It started under, you know, British colonialism.
So you said that was the picture in 2006.
Yeah.
Is the picture still the same now?
Yeah, it is still the same. But what it shows is that... So we're still exactly where we were in social performance and security.
Yeah.
So we haven't improved.
Yeah.
We haven't really worsened.
Yeah. It's just...
We're just stagnant.
Okay.
You know, we've made no real progress.
Yeah.
But, which is bad enough, right?
Yeah.
But what we see is erosion of our position in economy and governance. And big loss in governance, in the quality and then ranking of our governance. And so what you're seeing is in a way there is a convergence, right, on graphs of South Africa's position. And, you know, you have this duality of those indicators, but they're converging. But they're converging in the wrong direction.
Yes.
And so what it tells us, it's almost, the data is almost like it's a very powerful narrative of the fact that the post-apartheid project of leveraging the economy, this advanced economy, you know, right? Exclusive, unequal, you know, initially very racially divided, less so today,
right?
But still quite. You know, the for me, looking at the data, you know, I understand very clearly what Mandela and what Mbeki were trying to do. They were trying to leverage this enormous asset, which was this first world economy, to pull, you know,
the great population
out of poverty.
Okay.
Right? And that's what the essence of GEAR is, you know. And I think GEAR has been fundamentally misunderstood.
Yeah.
And so it was, be patient, my people. Right? We'll get there. We're gonna open up the economy. We're gonna attract a lot of investment because we don't have enough savings internally. And we're gonna allow these guys to grow and to make money.
Mm.
And we will impose upon them, you know, relatively benign taxation. But the economy will grow, and then there will be more, you know, income disposable for everybody, and that will create jobs, etc.
So for you, in terms of what you're seeing in the data, in terms of just drawing insights of some sort, where does the work need to happen, or where's your concern? Should we be concerned that there's the security and the social risk hasn't really changed, or should we be more concerned that there's an erosion on the governance and the economy side?
I think both. I think we cannot separate these things. We need to fix both problems at once.
Yeah.
And what really is concerning, and this is why we've been saying we're not very optimistic for the chance of a Cyril Ramaphosa to be successful, is that this kind of dislocation requires tremendous amount of political consensus, I feel, and unification of the social forces around a project of national development.
Mm.
And I think we had that, but we've lost it. And Paulo Kwane, for me, again, bringing back to the conversation, is that moment where we realize that the consensus we had actually was not tenable.
Yeah.
And the great paradox of South Africa, for me, from a political project standpoint, so social project standpoint, is that while we've had only one party in power since 1994, that party has failed to actually come up with a coherent consensus lasting, development project beyond the slogans, of developmental states, which is vacuous and empty, we've had this continuous debate within the ANC between different political factions and different political ideologies, the unions, the Communist Party, the more liberal branch, the more nationalist ones, and they continuously renegotiating the meaning of every project and slogan.
Yeah.
And that's extraordinary, Now, I often use the case of Mauritius, where it's exactly the opposite. You can have political parties changing, and they do change just about every often, either through change of alliance and you have to have new elections. But the socioeconomic project has been fixed for the past 30 years or so, 35 years. There is broad consensus as to what the goal of economic policy is.
Yeah.
So how do we do this? And the problem is that the more the economy is stressed, the more people are struggling for survival. And I think in South Africa right now, struggling for survival is it's there.
It's a reality.
It's not a theory. It's palpable everywhere.
Yeah.
The more people are struggling, the more I think the centrifugal forces are taking hold, and the more radical the conversation is becoming, where in fact we should all be coming together with an understanding of how dangerous the position actually is.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, and you said it earlier, I think these elections are very important because they're going to tell us whether we're pulling apart or we're pulling together.
Yeah. And then lastly, because in the interest of time, the last thing is, just with that election in mind, do you think, because one of the things that, this is just an observation, especially in terms of just investment into South Africa, is you sort of see a wait and watch approach from investors when they're looking at South Africa. Like, okay, guys, let's do the election. And then, because I think President Ramaphosa has been on a big investment drive, lots of commitments, etc. After that election, will we actually see that flow of investment coming into the country? And can we realistically predict that above 1% growth for this year? because I think it will help us to attack a lot of the problems that you're talking about.
No. So let me just say this. Above 1% growth is nowhere near where we need to be.
Yeah.
You know, if this is the conversation we're having, then we are having the wrong conversation. You know, if we're saying, oh, are we going to grow at 0.8 or 1.2%? Wow, we did 1.2%. You know, this is how much in trouble we are.
Yeah.
You know, we should be growing at 4.5%. The problem is that we don't have the basis to grow at that anymore. So, are investors kind of waiting and watching? Yes, they are. Are investors understanding how important the election is? You bet they do. But that applies not just to foreign investors. That applies to all the domestic sector. I mean, you can hear the sound of birds singing because no one is moving.
Yeah,
you know. I mean, to some extent, once that uncertainty has passed, things will start unlocking a little bit. But I can't help but think that people also are saying, you know, we've been caught before, right? I mean, when Ramaphosa became president, suddenly the new dawn and all these hopes and promises. And somehow, you know, they don't seem to have been fulfilled.
Mm.
And I mean, this, the elephant in the room being the Eskom crisis, right?
Yes, big one.
It's a huge elephant in the room, you know, so they're trying to chop that elephant in small parts, but, you know, it will still be an elephant,
yes.
You know, it will have a trunk sitting there and the butt sitting somewhere else,
yeah.
You know, and the body there, but it will still be an elephant. I think there is a sense that something new is needed, something quite radical, not RET, no, but something radical and different. What I don't see is I don't see, as I said earlier, in the political system, in the parties, in the discourses, I don't see the kind of understanding of how important this moment is.
Yeah.
I don't see the capacity of those elected to have enough political capital to do what's needed without rapid internal and external backlash.
Yeah. So, very interesting discussion. Big takeaway is just the fact that something new needs to happen in South Africa, especially after elections. But more than anything else, there needs to be buy-in from all political players, because it seems that there is a lack of political will at the moment to actually make the country do what actually needs to be done. Those are the words of our in-studio guest today. That's Unomix CEO Claude Bisek, just giving us some insights on research that they are doing with South Africa. Some data points that they are using, they're saying, how safe are you as a South African in the country and out the country, as a society? Where are we in terms of creating social capital? Where are we in terms of creating economic capital? And how strong are the institutions that actually govern the political system? So thank you so much to our guest. Please let us know. You told us your website earlier on, the social medias as well.
Yes, so we are on Twitter. Our website is unomix.com,
unomix.com.
I struggle with social media.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much. So that's it for today. That has been our BD Spotlight. You can definitely go and find us. You can hear all of our latest podcasts on Business Life under the Podcast Business Day Spotlight tab. On Twitter, you can use our hashtag. That's hashtag BD Spotlight. And you can subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your podcasts. For myself, Mudiwa Mob, Justice Kavadze, good evening, good afternoon, and good morning. Remember that Business Day Spotlight is a multimedia live production, and thank you to our amazing producer, that is Paige Mueller.